Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours. Hello, pulp fans and aficionados, and welcome to Issue 6 of Protecting Project Pulp, bringing you high-flying tales of classic pulp fiction weekly to feed your insatiable hunger for thrills, excitement, and adventure. I'm your host and daredevil pilot, Dave Robison. You know, I keep falling into the trap of thinking of pulp fiction as a genre. I think, ooh, I'm in the mood for a little pulp. Let's see what's in the old e-reader. The term has a distinct flavor in my mind, the same way crime drama or science fiction does. You think of it, and your mind conjures up feelings and images that you associate with it. But pulp isn't a genre. It's not about what the story's about, it's about how the stories are told. Broad strokes, colorful characters, incredible events. It's like walking a tightrope over a vat of little plastic balls while you're blindfolded. You know, it's exciting, and while there's certainly a sense of danger, the worst that's likely to happen is you fall into a vat of plastic balls. That's not true of all pulp fiction, but that's how it generally feels to me. Now, today's story definitely falls under that category. It's a flying story by Arthur J. Burks, titled Flying Suitors. It first appeared in the May issue of Flying Stories in 1929. Burks was one of the million-words-a-year pulp writers, crafting over 800 stories for pulp magazines like Weird Tales, Gangster Stories, and All Detective Fiction. He wrote in nearly all genres, except westerns and romance, which is kind of interesting because today's episode has a romantic thread running through it. He was a Marine and served in World War I, and while he was stationed in the Caribbean, he got a taste for the local culture, including some of the voodoo rituals practiced there, and that inspired him to write some stories that eventually made their way into Weird Tales. He retired in 1920 to commit to his writing full-time, and then re-enlisted in World War II, eventually retiring with the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. There's a very cool website called Pulp Serenade, run by Cullen Gallagher, a Brooklyn-based pulp writer. Cullen offered an intriguing post about Arthur J. Burks in his blog that included a quote that not only reveals a lot about Burks' character, but will also resonate with writers everywhere. "I like to write. I have to write, or go mad. The more I want to write, the faster the words tumble over themselves to get onto paper. I'm happy. I'm as interested in the outcome of my story as I dimly hope my readers will be. Though right then, I don't think about readers or editors or anybody else except the matter of getting my story on paper. It burns inside me, trying to get out, and I'm happy when it's streaking across the pages at top speed. Editors say I'm careless. I'm not. I'm sold on my story to the exclusion of all else. My fingers won't keep up with my mind, and typographical errors, therefore, seem to prove to editors that they're right in calling me careless." I think there's a lot of writers out there that can appreciate that point of view. Now, your narrator for this week's tale is Josie Babin. By day, Josie is a biologist, a happy little cog in the grand machine known as medical research. When not at work or enjoying the great outdoors of San Diego, she can be found at home with her three loving companions, two feline and one human. She records in a tiny bedroom library surrounded by literature and scientific works, as well as a few video game boxes. All right, buckle up and strap in. Make sure those goggles are snug and your scarf is knotted at your throat, because we're pulling back the throttle and taking to the air. The wide open skies are calling.
Flying by Arthur J. Burks. Good Lord, Shep, Tex. We'd all been sitting there, and I for one, and Sis, Tex, and Shep for the other three, had been looking into the east, toward the landing field of Paris Island, above which one of the baddiest flyers I had ever seen was doing his stuff. loops, spins, nosedives, falling leaves, immelmans, wingovers, and, well, I don't begin to know them all, and maybe there weren't any names for most of the things Bug Snelling was doing. I knew, as did the other three, that the flyer of the field was Bug Snelling. No one else ever did the stunts he did. That, said Shep Duncan, is what I call flying. That's the sort of thing I want to do. Wait, I cautioned, for that bird to land. Ever watched him? He always lands the same way, ending his flying day by giving the neighbors a treat. See, there he comes. Bugs was flying a monoplane, a light pursuit, that was faster than I am when I'm scared. Every afternoon I had watched him land, and he had a habit of coming into the field lightning fast, diving under the telephone line which paralleled one side of the field. I'd watched him every evening, as aforesaid, and whether I was hoping he'd break his neck is nobody's business. Anyway, I'd always watched him and wondered how long he would last. Well, he banked away around and came in as usual, flying like a bat out of Dante's masterpiece, diving down to swoop under those wires and over the concrete road into the huge field. Gosh, those wires looked low. Not much clearance, and a barbed wire fence still lower down. Close flying. But Bug Snelling had made it 100 times or more, to my knowledge. But somehow, this time, maybe because both Shep Duncan and Tex McCullough were going to take up this sport, I watched with new interest, and all of us fell silent as Snelling came in. Closer and closer he came to the telephone line. Lower and lower he dropped his trucks. Nothing much, after all. He'd make it this time, as he'd made it 100 times before. We all got the idea at the same time and relaxed our tension, sitting back again in our chairs. Then a gust of wind did something to Bugs. Just as he would have zipped under the wires as usual, he was shot up into the air as though he'd hit a dip in a toboggan slide. His trucks, traveling at 140 miles an hour, hooked onto the wires, and Bugs turned over on his nose in the batting of an eyelash. He dived right into that concrete road on the other side of the line. Now, I maintain that when an airplane dives into a concrete road at that many miles per hour, and from a height of 30 feet or so, it hits like the devil and then some. At least Bugs did. Well, believe it or not, Bugs' ship was a wreck. The biggest piece left of it could have been used handily for a toothpick. And as for Bugs, well, Bugs had made his last dive under telephone wires, unless they have telephones and airplanes in heaven, and was gathered in on the Marine Corps Paris Island supply of blotters. Shep looked at Tex. I looked at Shep and Tex. Shep and Tex looked at me. This was their out. They'd put in for aviation, and their papers probably hadn't left their respective offices yet. All they had to do to renege was to get their papers and have them tossed into the wastebasket, after the safety-first precaution of tearing them to bits. But next day, those two saps left for wherever they were going to get their wings. 4 months later, I was ordered to Santo Domingo and took Sis with me. We had a nice house in Gasque, and such plenty of good drinks, all soft drinks, of course, and had grown to like it. Breakfast at 9 o'clock. Out of the west, there suddenly came the blasting roar of a low-flying ship. I dashed out. I knew already what was what, though. For Shep had preceded me to Santo Domingo, and I'd heard enough about his stunting to know it was probably he. Besides, this low flying over the city was against orders, which is why Shep, being that sort of a buzzard, was doing just that. Sis and I ran out. Shep was certainly putting on a show. A burro, hazed long by a native woman and piled high with market stuff, was trudging down the road towards us. She looked back as the motor blasted in her ears, and then started to run. But too late, as the titles say. The burro only wagged his ears, unconcerned-like, not knowing what was coming. Not all the burros in Santo Domingo had as yet been trained by Shep Duncan. Shep tilted his Diaveland up in the air and gave her the gun right over the old woman and her burro. The old woman's clothes flew up over her head, and she squatted in the road as though an armored tank had run over her, covered by her clothes like a tent. The burro took to his heels, and hobos, melones, mame apples, patatas, chicharrones, every marketable thing the burro bore, was scattered from here to there as though a hurricane had done it. But Shep wasn't worried. By the time the woman had decided that Judgment Day hadn't arrived after all, Shep had touched his wheels to the flat roof of our house and had ducked on over the city, his wheels spinning madly. His ship was careening from side to side. He flew like a crazy man. We got to the roof by a ladder and watched Shep go winging his way thence. We stood upright on the roof, in the dust of which we had caught a glimpse of the trace of his wheels, and watched him go. Over the Asama he had banked left, flying close to the water, as we knew because we couldn't see him for a moment. Then he came into sight, climbing straight up, grabbing for altitude with his prop, and we knew, and gasped as the knowledge came home to us, that he'd flown under the bridge which spanned the river, where he had something like 3 feet of clearance for his wings. Just before we went down from the roof, we saw another ship which was so far away, almost straight over us, that we could scarcely hear the engine. That flyer had so much altitude that he could have been married and divorced by the time his ship could have struck the ground in a tight spin. "That, sis," I said, "is Tex McCullough, safe and sane flyer. Always believes in having gliding radius, down here where fields are few and far between." Sis was a bit thoughtful as we climbed down the ladder and went into the house. Then Sis delivered her bombshell. "Look, bud," she told me, "I love both those boobs, so help me, but I'm not sure I like a fraid cat as a husband. Same time, early widowhood doesn't appeal to me. I want you to take rides with each of those fellows, and let me know what you think about it." "But sis," I said, suddenly having visions of ships falling 10 miles in flames, or crashing into the steel trusses of bridges, "I thought you told me once you preferred to manage your own affairs." "I do," says the kid sister. "I'm doing it. You're one of my means to an end." The way she said "end" somehow stuck in my craw. But, well, did you ever have a persistent kid sister? Next day, I hopped to Macoris with Shep Duncan on trumped-up official business, while Sis waited at the field for me to come back, which I had doubts about doing. I'll pass over that ride speedily. We took the hats off 7 natives riding burros, spun our trucks on 4 Subanas, each the size of a handkerchief, with trees 100 feet high walling them all around, flew along the road with altitude of something under 3 feet, blew smoke back down the huge chimneys of 3 sugar refineries, dropped into the Macquarie's field over telephone wires, so close to him that they hummed like jews harps after we'd passed the fact. I heard them above the roaring of the motor. Did our business, took off for the return under those wires, climbing straight up right alongside the poles, replaced the hats on the heads of 6 out of 7 of the natives on the way back. The 7th saw us coming and ducked. Sucked the smoke back up the chimneys of the 3 sugar refineries, flew along the road upside down, touched those 4 fields still upside down, while Shep kicked up dirt by hitting the ground with his helmet as we passed over. And, well, isn't that long enough for one sentence? When I stepped out of the Diaveland, think of it, a Diaveland, at the home field, I had lost exactly 50 pounds, was perspiring like a black man in a Dominican election campaign, and my knees were knocking together so badly that the mechanic kept the motor of the ship revved up to kill the sound and save me the embarrassment. "Sis," I choked, "sis, if you feel yourself slipping where this bird Shep is concerned, shoot him before it gets too serious and save us both a lot of worry and trouble." But Sis only looked enigmatical and informed me that she had it all arranged for me to fly to Asua with Tex McCullough, that the other ship on the field, idling at the blocks, had simply been waiting for me to arrive. Well, I refused point blank. Of course I went. Kid sister, you know. In wide spirals, Tex lifted that old de Havilland. Honest, I never realized that riding in an airplane could be so comfortable, like riding on Granddaddy's rocking chair at home. The field below kept getting smaller and smaller, further and further away, but Tex, watching his instruments, looking over first one side, then the other, kept climbing until I thought we'd starve to death before he pointed her nose at Aswa. When he did so, the altimeter said 12,000, which was 11,800 feet higher than I'd ever been before. But I loved it. We sailed along like love's young dream. Piles of clouds were everywhere as soon as we got into the Cordilleras. Holes in the ground down to earth looked like wells 100 miles deep, with little cigar box houses at the bottom of them. The sun was shining, and the clouds sure looked pretty. Then the bottom fell out of the atmosphere. We must have dropped 500 feet while my safety belt almost cut my legs in two, and I pinched two huge chunks out of the cowling in my pit. But Tex, unbothered, examining his instruments like an automaton, caught her up again and flew on. I was thinking, with Shep flying at an elevation of something under 10 feet, a sudden drop of 500 feet might have spelled disaster. But, well, Shep hadn't dropped. Then we hit another bump, or kiss me quick, or hole in the road, or something, and the right wing fell plumb square off. At least for a minute I thought it had. Only it hadn't. It was pointing at the earth, but wasn't going there. Rather, the whole plane was, but it was still intact. We must have flown on the edge of that hole for a quarter of a mile with our right wing pointing at the ground, 9 or 10 miles, more or less, down there at the bottom of those wells somebody had dug in the clouds. And all the time, Tex sat there like a dummy, manipulated this and manipulated that, until finally straightened her out and got going again. Then we reached Aswa. Still the dummy in the pit, Tex dropped his left wing and started down in a screaming sideslip, which had me glued to the upper side of my pit with mucilage that was the stickiest I had ever experienced, probably much of it compounded with my own perspiration. He leveled, nosed over, went into a power dive, leveled, sideslipped again, while the houses in Aswa got so big with such suddenness they looked as though somebody was blowing them up, like kids blow up those toy balloons you buy at county fairs. Any moment, I looked for him to burst with a loud report. Then I saw the cemetery, right under our feet after a manner of speaking, and was just thinking how handy we'd be for planting, if anything went wrong, when Tex dropped the Diavolan's wheels over the top of the cemetery wall and set the ship down. I shudder to think of how Shep would have come into this field if Tex was a safe and sane flyer. "Listen, bud," said Tex, just before I pulled the prop for the return. "Air's kind of light here. Worst field in the Republic, you know. But if we go clear to the end of the field, I figure we'll clear the cemetery wall by exactly 6 inches. Let's go." Well, the dummy flyer had it guessed about right. When we were within 40 feet of that wall, which was 2 feet thick and made of bricks or stones, I didn't get out to ascertain which, our trucks were still glued to the ground. I swear that at the last moment Tex raised up in the pit and gave a sort of upward heave with his whole body in order for us to clear that wall, which we did by just those 6 inches he had guessed at, if not less. Blew the fur the wrong way on the backs of the thatched huts of Aswa, and flew at 50 feet or so until the cool breeze from Ocoa Bay came in, and Tex could climb out of the vacuum. 10,000, all sorts of gliding radius, and we were slamming back for the capital city. "Sis," I remarked to that kid sister of mine, "my advice to you is that if you decide to take one of these gazebos, take either one of them. One's a fool on wheels, the other is a tailor's dummy." Then I fainted. Too much excitement close to the ground, too much rarefied atmosphere in the upper air lanes, and I had lost 70 pounds. I came to with my head in Sis's lap, and she was talking, which wasn't anything unusual. "I'll have to find some other way," she wailed. "I can't marry both of them, and I can't decide which one I want. As a brother, you're a darn good wet blanket, the world's most proficient as a matter of fact." "Well," I said, "you know your own business best." But I wondered how she was going to decide. I kept on wondering as the weeks passed. Sis was very quiet and thoughtful. Every day two planes flew over our house. One invariably touched wheels to our roof. The other was invariably so high he couldn't have picked out anything but the approximate location of our domicile. Sis thought Tex was something of a fraid cat, and that Shep was too reckless, such recklessness being conducive to early widowhood on the part of whoever married Shep. On the other hand, Tex might somehow climb so high someday that he wouldn't be able to find his way back down. Then I got up one morning and called Sis. She didn't answer. I waited for half an hour, called her again. Yep, there was the usual letter on the bureau. Have gone into the Cordilleras, somewhere between Mano Guayabo and San Jose de Ocoa, to wrestle with my soul, if I have one, and decide which of these two chaps I want. I can't have them both cluttering up our front porch forever. Well, there's a lot of territory between Mano Guayabo and San Jose de Ocoa, and it's all jungle except what is mountain peaks, and I had a hunch Sis could take care of herself. She was my sister, see? But then I was worried, too. The hinterland was no place for a young white girl to be in. The gentlemen of the interior liked white girls, if one were to judge by the way they eyed those they were privileged to gaze upon. Besides that, the jungle was full of gavilleros, those malcontents who saw off the muzzles of shotguns and rifles, and go to the hills to rob and waylay. The fact that our one and only maid was missing, too, didn't help me any. I'm a bum cook. But, as I said, there's lots of territory between Mano Guayabo and San Jose de Ocoa, and maybe she hadn't even gone that way. She didn't want me to butt in, and that was plain enough. All I knew for a certainty was that she hadn't booked passage on a ship to the States, though I wish she had. 5 days later, I heard a knock on the door at 4 o'clock in the morning. Then I heard a lot of sobbing. I got up and went to see what was what. It was the maid who had gone with Sis. She was ragged because thorns had almost stripped her, and what I could see of her body thus exposed was bruised and bleeding. Her feet were raw and crimson from much running over sharp rocks. "Your sister," she wailed, then stopped. "Yes," I said. "My sister. What of her?" And I shook the maid until her teeth rattled. "We had plenty of provisions. A map of the country," went on the maid. "Listen," I told her. "If you were a witness answering questions before a court-martial, they'd let you tell your family history and the state of the weather, past and present, before they'd make you answer directly. But I'm not a court-martial. What about Sis?" "Captured by gavilleros," she wailed. "Fought until they overpowered her, but refused to listen to the pleading of their jefe, who tossed her into a hut and told her he'd give her 24 hours to decide what she'd do about it." "Where?" I shouted, shaking her again. "El Jaime, back of El Tablazo, which is back of San Cristobal," she told me straightly. "And we haven't much time left." "Well, you've guessed it. I telephoned to both Tex and Shep, and had myself driven out to the field, where two ships were idling at the blocks, all set to go. I'd been to El Jaime, mountainous, no place to land, but a chute jump now. I didn't like chutes, nor airplanes, but she was my kid sister, and I didn't like jefe gavilleros either. I got in the afterpit of Tex's ship, the maid in the afterpit of Shep's, and we started off like a pair of comets, scooting down the field until Hades wouldn't have taken out insurance on either one of us. Well, and what do you think? Shep started circling, madly circling, I'll admit, for whole handsfuls of altitude, while Shep started for El Jaime by the shortest route, which took not too much account of the treetops that intervened. And when I say he traveled, I mean just that. It goes to show what love will do. In a trice, because their sweetheart was in trouble, the two might have changed minds. All Tex's preconceived ideas went into the discard as he flashed towards El Jaime at 130 miles an hour, just above the treetops. The exhaust flames bathed the sides of the ship until I had a hunch we'd be going down in flames long before El Jaime was reached. Far above us, 8,000 feet up at least, I could see the exhaust flames of Shep's ship as he was making time too. Then, far ahead, where El Jaime was supposed to be, we could see a light which looked like the light glow above a big city, though I knew El Jaime was little more than a name, and not one with which to conjure either. 10 minutes later, I knew the answer. The jungle there was a raging furnace. My heart was in my mouth. Forgetting my own fears on the instant, I leaned forward, literally willing our ship to greater speed. As we approached, the light grew brighter. The maid had told me the approximate location of the gavillero encampment, and I could locate El Jaime itself from the confirmation of the ground about it, and by the fact that it was on the bank of a mountain stream whose name at this moment I don't remember. Well, we reached El Jaime well ahead of Shep, and Tex was looking over the side of the ship, down upon a clearing no bigger than a tablecloth. All mountains here, and the natives had merely cleared away a strip of jungle in which to build this settlement, a clearing so up and down that a fly couldn't have alighted upon it without breaking his neck. How could we do anything for Sis? The clearing was a furnace, because all the jungle around it was in seething flames. The clearing was crowded, proof that the gavilleros had been trapped by the fire. Low down swooped Tex, driving for the clearing. Already we could feel the terrific heat which rushed up at us, but I didn't mind. I was watching the clearing for Sis. I could make out the natives as we swooped over, and they certainly were scared pink. They held up their arms to us as though they prayed. Then I saw Sis, recognizable because she was the only woman there who was dressed in breeches and her hair was hanging around her shoulders. And how could we help? Jump? Sure, and only get into the trap Sis was already in. Getting in and dying with her wouldn't help Sis. Getting in and getting back out with her would help. And nothing but that side hill to land on. I looked up at Shep's ship as we swooped over, zooming for altitude from which to dive back, and saw a black bundle come catapulting down from the ship. Good Lord, what could Shep be thinking? That maid with him couldn't fly a ship. And besides, I saw that Shep, because of his high altitude, the winds or something, was going to land outside the clearing, outside the circle of flames which hedged the clearing in. His chute filled with air, and he was striving with might and main, by pulling on the shrouds, to get into the flame-swept clearing. His ship was spinning down, too, and I watched for another figure, the figure of the maid, to come catapulting down behind Shep. But no such figure showed, and the spinning ship disappeared behind the side of a mountain shoulder as we, Tex and I, banked around and came back. Well, Tex couldn't land here, neither could Shep. It looked sort of up to me. I slapped Tex on the shoulder and signaled that I wanted to jump. Instantly, a grin of relief on his face, he nosed up, half stalled, and I went over about 700 feet. I forgot that it was my first jump, forgot to be afraid, because of the fact that the heat which reached up for me was burning my eyebrows off before I had any more than nicely got started down. I was going to hit the clearing, all right. And then what? I struck, and my whole body seemed to shrivel with the heat. Sis came running for me. I grabbed her around the waist. We looked up at Tex, swooping in again, and then up at Shep, who was just disappearing into the jungle outside the flames. I felt like uttering a wail of despair. Trapped, Sis and I, though there was relief in the fact we were going out together. I even felt sorry for the gavilleros who were trapped with us. The best things the natives did, however, was die. So though their cries to the Virgin for forgiveness and mercy bothered me, I didn't pity them overmuch. How'd this happen, Sis? I yelled at her above the roar of the flames. I tried to escape, she cried, her face as red as a beet with the heat, and couldn't make it. So I set fire to my hut, knowing they wouldn't leave me to roast, and this is the result. I looked all around. I had an idea that without Sis, I might manage to get through, but Sis would never make it. Over our head roared Tex's ship. I looked up again and gasped in surprise and disbelief. Tex was going to set his ship down on that side hill. He came stalling in, doing everything under the sun to his ship to cut his flying speed, trying to keep her at an angle so he wouldn't crack her up getting in, and, as the Lord is my witness, he touched his trucks to the side of that hill. I saw what he intended doing in time and yelled my head off to the natives. To them, maybe, this bird from the skies was a messenger from on high, come down to take them out of danger. Maybe that's why they conquered their fear of the bird. Anyway, at my command, a gang of them tailed on to the ship, stopped its rolling, keeping out of the prop by the grace of whatever it is that looks after fools, drunkards, and primitives, and Tex jumped out. "Put her in the pit!" I yelled at him. "I think I can get out of here if I'm alone." "You didn't think," shouted Tex in return, "that I dropped in here for you, did you?" His face was haggard and set. Well, despite the fact that it seemed hopeless, still it was our only hope. We tailed the ship around until she pointed the long way of the clearing. It was like trying to take off on the roof of a house, and the natives held on to her while Tex revved her up. At his signal, having absorbed his few words of instruction via me as an interpreter, the natives held the ship until she was blasting for a million. Then they let her go. I thought she'd never get off. The fire from that inferno fairly bathed the ship, and she finally left the ground and Tex lifted her. If the fire hadn't burned off the tops of the trees, Tex would have taken him with his landing gear. But they were away, and a disappointed gang of natives was left behind, wondering just what they'd got out of helping their prisoner away. I asked for the jefe. "Will you promise to go to the capital city and turn in your arms if I'll get you out of here? You and all of your men?" I shouted at him. He'd have promised anything then, just to get away, so he nodded his head. Just as I started off, my blouse over my head, toward the spot I had picked because the fire was thinnest there, a blackened figure, with hair burned off, pants in rags and smoking, came through that selfsame thin place and ran wildly, stumblingly towards us. Yep, it was Shep. "The maid," I began. "Fool," he shouted. "Didn't you see me dump her out at the field at the last minute? We needed a pit for your sis to sit in when we got her. Where is she?" "Gone with Tex," I said. "And we are going." Shep led the way because he knew it. It led along the stream into which we wallowed like so many pigs, soaking our clothes by the simple expedient of dropping down and rolling in the water every 10 feet or so, and of crawling on our bellies, noses and faces under, when the going got too hot. We got out, and the Gavieras decided that a promise given under stress was no soap, and that, if left to their own devices, they'd have found a way out themselves without our help. So Shep pulled his gun on them. It was wet and probably wouldn't fire, but they didn't know that. A chap who could drop out of the sky, then come through fire without burning to death, might be able to make even waterlogged guns fire. Taking the hint, I pulled my gun also. Fortunately for us, the natives had left the clearing without theirs, which were inside a bunch of huts that by now were more or less in a state of ashes. It was dusk of that evening before we got back to the city. I told the commanding general of Shep's heroic jump, of his trip through the flames, of how his quickness of wit had corralled the Gavieros and made it possible for us to bring them in. Shep was a hero. The CG recommended him for a medal of some kind and overlooked the loss of the de Havilland. "Shep was the real hero," I told Sis. "You ought to take him. He had guts. Through air, fire, and water, he came to us, and if it hadn't been for him, I wouldn't be here now." "He rescued you, bud," says Sis to me. "But Tex rescued me, which makes a difference. Shep always played to the grandstand, and I admit he's given me many a thrill. But brains win out in the long run. Besides, the Padre married me to Tex before you and Shep got in with your prisoners."
All right, ease back on the throttle, gang, and bring her in for a landing. You just heard Flying Suitors by Arthur J. Burks, narrated by Josie Babin. One of the reasons I love pulp fiction so much is the spirit of adventure that's at the heart of every tale. Pushing the boundaries, internally and externally, seems to be one of the consistent themes of most pulp tales. As a pilot, the hero of this story really personified that spirit. Keep in mind, there was no space program at this time. Sputnik wasn't even orbiting the Earth. The sky was, literally, the limit for the world's adventurers. So the brave folks that flew those skies were like today's astronauts. It's no wonder flying stories fall within the vast scope of pulp fiction. There would be no greater adventure for the human spirit than conquering the skies. It's easy, I think, to get swept up in the notion that adventures have to be big, grand things filled with mortal peril and life-or-death stakes. And they certainly can be, of course, but Webster defines adventure as an undertaking usually involving danger and unknown risks, or an exciting or remarkable experience. Now, whichever definition you prefer, there's nothing in there that defines the scope of the experience. Danger takes many forms. Try driving rush hour traffic in a big city sometime. And risks don't have to be mortal to be important. I think each of us struggles for balance between the desire for excitement and adventure and the impulse, as so eloquently expressed by Bilbo Baggins in The Hobbit, that adventures make one late for dinner. But wherever you fall in that spectrum of sentiment, life always seems to include unsettling or jarring circumstances that push you out of that cozy, comfortable, on-time feeling. I think the difference between an adventurer and a hobbit is whether those inevitable cacophonies of experience are avoided as distractions or embraced as opportunities. Now, we don't have an interview for you this week, though fear not, there will be many to come in future issues. This week, I'd like to introduce another thread of the PPP weave, where we showcase something cool in the world of pulpish fiction. It might be a cool website, or an awesome convention, or maybe a cool bookstore that's doing something fabulous in the realm of pulpish adventure. This week, we'd like to showcase a project in the works by a remarkable young man named Matthew Wayne Selznick. Matt is a musician, a social media wizard, and an author of fiction and nonfiction. A few years back, he wrote a remarkable novel titled Brave Men Run, about how the world in 1985 would respond to suddenly discovering the existence of superpowered beings living among us. The book received much acclaim, and now Matt is preparing to write a sequel to Brave Men Run titled Pilgrimage. He wants, of course, for the book to be everything it can be, and that includes costs for professional editing, artwork, and setting up the novel for print. To offset these costs, Matt has launched a Kickstarter project, allowing fans and advocates of independent publishing to support his efforts. There are some remarkable incentives for those choosing to contribute. It's worth your time to check it out. And friends, Matt Selznick's project is the very definition of an adventure. An undertaking usually involving danger and unknown risks, right? Well, the unknown risks are covered. There's no telling if the project will be backed fully or not. And with Kickstarter, if the project doesn't reach its goal, all the money gets returned. That's definitely a risk. And the danger part? Now put yourself in Matt's shoes for a second. You have a great idea for a book, a sequel to one you've already done. You've got the story all outlined. All you have to do is write it. But you can't afford to pay those upfront expenses. Maybe, if enough people think it's a worthwhile project, they can throw a few bucks at it and make it happen. You see the danger, right? If the project doesn't get funded, then the world has sent the message that something you're passionate about just isn't that important. How's that for danger? Now, I've backed this project because I enjoy Matt's work, and I like how he does what he does. Check him out. His website is at mattselznick.com, and the link to that site will be available in the liner notes for this issue. You can also go to the Kickstarter site and check out the project, or go to crowdfundpilgrimage.info, and it'll take you right to it. And speaking of adventure, you won't find a more adventurous band of thrill-seeking madmen than the team that makes Protecting Project Pulp possible. Our assistant editor, Fred Heimbau, is a daredevil ace, banking his sleek editorial craft through the jungles and canyons of lost worlds, landing only to snatch up a wayward pulp story to bring back for your enjoyment. Our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, is a master mechanic and audio grease monkey, tuning the sound engine of our fine craft to peak perfection. And our editor and producer, Tony Smith, is the captain of this aerial circus, leading us to cloud-dappled skies fraught with adventure. We hope you enjoyed this week's tale. We're flying at full throttle here at Protecting Project Pulp, so to make sure you don't miss a single flight of adventure, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or through our website at protectingprojectpulp.com. While you're there, leave a comment on the episode post or in the forums. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what we've done, what we're doing, and maybe help us chart our course into the skies of tomorrow. Next week, lace up your gloves and get limber, because we've got a great boxing story titled There's Hicks in All Trades by Tom Thursday. This story is so steeped in the language and culture of the pulp era that you're going to talk different for days afterwards. I know I did. Ask my wife. Until then, I remain your host and friendly native guide, Dave Robison, reminding you that your story is happening right now. Adventure is happening all around you right now. And you get to decide if your story is going to be an adventure tale or not. I'll see you next week. This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.